The Tom Woods Show, episode 2126.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. I'm giving away three free courses from my Liberty Classroom. One of them is ex-Marxist Michael Rechtenwald teaching you about critical theory so you can understand leftism and fight it better, as well as our course on how Alexander Hamilton screwed up America and the history of the conservative and libertarian movements. Check it out at 3freecourses.com. Hey, everybody. Tom Woods here. Very glad to be joined by our old friend Dan McCarthy, who is editor of Modern Age, which I recommend you check out at modernagejournal.com. And we're going to talk about an article of his forthcoming that I like very much. I just had a chance to read. And it has to do with prospects for conservatives, but there's plenty of overlap with libertarians because we're both kind of on the outs and we're both anti-establishment and we both face an uphill battle in some ways. And yet, maybe potential successes in others. So I think there's a lot to talk about. Dan is somebody who, even though he is a conservative, he's my kind of conservative. He's very familiar with libertarianism. He's actually read the work. He agrees with us much of the time. But he's always got something interesting to say, and I think this will be a great conversation. So here we go. Dan, welcome back to the Tom Woods Show.
Thanks, Tom. It's a delight to be here.
I like your article. We're going to be talking about it. It's not yet, well, at least by the time people hear this, not yet published, but for people who wait a while before listening to this episode, they may have the good fortune of seeing it in print. But this is an article for Modern Age that will be coming out in the next issue, which is, as of this recording, what is the next issue?
That's the spring 2022 issue.
Okay. And so it's called, your shorter version, I think, in The Spectator had a different title, but this is called Prospects for Conservatives 2022. And there's kind of a subhead up top that says, the American left has nowhere to go but down, yet what will replace it? All right, very interesting. Now, before we get into the part of the piece where you go through what you describe as four principal sources that converge to create the conservatism Americans are familiar with, I want to start off by acknowledging what you say at the very beginning of the piece, which is that the left has tremendous institutional power, just from one institution to another. We all know what those are: academia, the mainline churches, corporate America now, and on and on and on. And yet, they still can't be sure they're going to win in the midterms, or that they're not going to be humiliated in the midterms, or that they're going to win in 2024. How is this possible? So there is, despite all of it, the propaganda, the demonization campaigns, there is nevertheless a kind of a resistance. And a great, like, overwhelming chunk of that resistance is in some way attached to conservatism, if not necessarily Conservatism Inc., then to conservatism. So first of all, can you just reflect on that for a minute? Because, you know, we've always kind of been the underdogs. I would say people like you and me have always been the underdogs, but never now more than before. And yet politically, it looks like conservatives, even ones who don't deserve it, may necessarily enjoy a windfall. It's an amazing thing.
Yeah, it goes to show the inadequacy of left-wing ideology. And really, what the American left is experiencing right now is a parallel to what happened in the Soviet Union and in Eastern Europe. You have an ideology which has sweeping power over all of society, and yet because that ideology is false and has a false view of human nature, it fails to make people happy, it fails to satisfy people, and so you see a rejection of it breaking out all along the way. And this is, I think, why progressives, why leftists are so desperate to have the total control they've been aspiring to. It's why they can't tolerate, you know, Elon Musk taking over Twitter. They can't tolerate, you know, Facebook posts that question the science or what have you. It's because if you allow any channel of dissent, then the spell will be broken. And the fact that this ideology is not able to secure support and legitimacy from most people. So leftists right now are in a kind of panic. And it's very interesting to watch them. They have, you know, full control of the U.S. Congress right now. They have Joe Biden in the White House. The social networks are still very much under their control. Elon Musk hasn't actually taken over Twitter yet, and, you know, that may not happen in the end. And corporate media, corporate America is very woke. The mainstream media is entirely, on the left. And yet for all of this, progressives seem to be very, very unhappy. And they seem to be very uncertain about their future. And the reason for that is simply that what they're trying to impose on people is a lie. And the fact that people are going to reject it and already reject it means that the whole project is just doomed to failure and collapse.
I'm sure you're familiar with a law professor named Frank Buckley.
Of course, yeah. He's a good guy.
Okay, so he wrote a book on American secession. Not calling for it, but describing what it might look like and how it could come about. And I remember saying to him on this program that the reason I wasn't entirely convinced by what he was saying was that I wasn't sure that there was much of the American left that would be satisfied to let a big chunk go. They want to re-educate this big chunk. They can't let them go. They have, remember Edmund Burke's expression, armed doctrines. They have got to impose these on people. They can't let them just go do their own thing. And Buckley came back with, but I think what they're starting to wonder is, even though Bill Kristol, I think it was Bill Kristol, I can't remember which one, or maybe one of the Podoritzes years ago said the culture war is over and the left won. But Buckley is saying, I think some of them are looking at the political results and wondering, did we really win? And seeing some of the backlash against them and wondering, have we really won or not? And he says that as they begin to wonder that and realize that, maybe their minds might change about national divorce. Now, I don't want to get into a side conversation about national divorce, but what do you think about that idea that maybe some of them are looking and saying, gee, we were so convinced we had won this thing because we just imposed ourselves on everybody, but maybe we haven't?
Well, I think that's like saying, is Gorbachev going to voluntarily dissolve the Soviet Union? My view is that no, these reformers of decaying ideologies, what they're trying to do is actually keep their empire together. And they're not going to succeed, but I don't think that they are so reform-minded or so capable of change themselves that they can accept the collapse of their project. So I don't really think progressives are going to demonstrate much tendency even to, accept something like federalism. And we see right now, the idea that Florida is pursuing its own path, this is something that the left is outraged by. I mean, Governor DeSantis is despised as much as Donald Trump is right now because he is, leading Florida in a direction that progressives don't like, even though the progressives themselves are not being affected by what happens in Florida because most of them don't live in Florida. Nevertheless, they're outraged by it. There was a good segment maybe a year or two ago on Tucker Carlson's program where Tucker Carlson was talking about how, red state Americans are not obsessed with what's going on, in San Francisco or New York City. They're not thinking about, how they can possibly impose evangelical Christianity or, traditional constitutional thought on progressive enclaves across the country. It only goes the other way. It's only the case that progressives find it unacceptable that there's anyone in the country, anywhere, who is living according to a set of customs that the progressives don't like. They really do have an imperial universalist mentality, and it's a sign of just their lack of grounding among human beings, right? They are attached to a set of abstractions, and they have tremendous difficulty accepting that real flesh and blood human beings are just not clay that can be molded by ideologues who think they happen to possess a monopoly on the truth and sort of the true rational ideology that will lead you to the end of history.
In other words, the imperial ambition of these people to rule over everyone of differing ideologies is so strong, it even eclipses their own presumed desire to make some places in the United States more progressive than they are now. If we had a much, much more developed federalism or even actual national divorce, they could take California and make it into everything they want. Jeff Deist makes this point a lot. They could get everything they want. They could have national health care. They could have it single payer. I mean, you could go down the list. Anything they want, they could have it tomorrow. And yet, they would rather harass that guy in Florida than get it.
Well, what they ultimately want is to rule. And so, in that sense, it's not about national health care. It's not about, any particular set of policies that might be pursued in one place or another. It really is about basically forcing everyone to accept their point of view about, fundamental human nature and about the nature of our communities. And if people are not willing to do that, the left is going to continue to try to find ways to compel them to do so. You know, that's why the left has made such a priority and has had great success in taking over the educational system. They realize that if people are left to the formation by their own families, by their churches, by their communities, that people would never accept leftism in that case. What has to be done instead is to take people away, take children away from their families, take teenagers out of their home communities, you know, put them in colleges and universities, and completely try to rewrite their way of life as well as their ideas. And only then can you, you know, sort of create a blank slate and then go from that blank slate to filling that blank slate with the kind of programming or writing that progressives would like people to have. And this project, you know, has created this really horrible culture war that we have in this country. It's created a lot of human misery. I mean, you look at the numbers for, you know, young people, especially young women who have sort of crises of identity and are very unhappy. Look at the enormous figures for mental illness among young people right now. This is the result of progressivism trying to turn people into what they aren't.
I want to run through, if we may, the four different sources that you're looking at of conservatism as it exists today. And you segue into this by saying, all right, conservatism, given that this superficial appearance that the left is destined to be triumphant everywhere, given the institutional power they have, given that that has not translated into permanent political victory, and also given that a solid at least 40%, if not half the country, is opposed or strongly opposed to them, the question now is who will sweep in to take advantage of this? And so, of course, naturally, one such group would be conservatives. But conservatives themselves are an amalgam of all different types of ways of thinking. So which one of these ways will wind up being triumphant in the end? So you've got a few of these. I'd like to skip the first one just for the time being and jump ahead, if I may, into what you call country patriotism. Can you describe that?
Yeah, that is simply a love of one's home place. So it is a very local kind of patriotism. And it is a patriotism which is often regionalist rather than nationalist. And even to the extent that it's nationalist, it tends to be a view of the nation state that is derived from perhaps red state experience or the experience of Americans who do not live in major urban areas. So local patriotism is basically just a love of home. You know, there's this wonderful phrase that Roger Scruton coined called oikophobia. It's a strange sounding word, but oikos is the Greek word for home. And phobia, as we all know, of course, is this word for a fear. So oikophobia is the fear of home. It's the fear of one's neighbors. It's the fear of, you know, one's locality. And this kind of fear, this oikophobia, is characteristic of progressives. They prefer strangers over neighbors, which is a very unnatural thing. They do it because they think it's, you know, a magnanimous thing to do. They think it's they're called upon to be more kind to strangers than to their own neighbors and kin. At least that's what they would say, and that's how they would justify themselves. But in fact, I think actually what we see here is that progressives, they thrive on alienation. And to the extent that they are able to break people away from their traditional connections to their hometowns or to their neighbors, to their family, to the extent they're able to weaken these, you know, sort of natural local connections, people become detached and they become more easily controlled and molded by progressives. So this form of conservatism that I'm calling local patriotism or country patriotism is an attempt to defend that local nexus, which shapes, you know, sort of personal outlooks and personal character. And oftentimes the conservatives who are motivated primarily by country patriotism, they're not necessarily very book-oriented. They are people who simply, you know, have a feeling that the way we've been doing things, you know, in your neighborhood, in my neighborhood, is the right way of doing things, and we want to insist on preserving the way of life that we've known. And so these conservatives are often easily attacked by the left. They're accused of xenophobia because they prefer their neighbors and their neighborhoods to foreign countries and strangers. And they're attacked as isolationists because they're more concerned about the fentanyl problem in their own hometown rather than who's going to control Ukraine. And these local patriotic conservatives are often very ill represented by Conservatism Inc. in Washington, D.C. and, you know, in the media world and so forth. because they are, you know, sort of based in the red states. They're based not only in the red states, but in the red towns and local communities, which are, you know, many elite conservatives simply think that all of that is retrograde and embarrassing, and they would rather kind of look for other ways to understand their own, you know, maybe more urban conservatism that are not connected to this kind of basically small town mentality.
Dan, I read this description and I listen to you talking now, and of course I think of Bill Kaufman, who I think embodies this so perfectly. You and I were, of course, at the Rally for the Republic that Ron Paul held in 2008, and Bill spoke there, and he gave one of, to my mind, one of the most memorable speeches I've seen in all the years I've gone to these things. And he said exactly that. I'd like to actually reproduce for the listeners a couple of passages. He talked about his love for my own place, the little postage stamp of ground on which I and my neighbors and family live, a piece of the world which means nothing to the empire, but means everything to me. And then he says, you can't have a healthy home and a worldwide empire. They can't coexist. You can't care about Baghdad and your own backyard. McCain chooses Baghdad. We take our stand in our backyards, on our front porches, in neighborhood diners and sandlot baseball diamonds and country churches and rock and roll clubs and volunteer fire departments and all those preciously little voluntary institutions that are the lifeblood of this beautiful country. Well, that's it. Even though Bill is very well-read and educated, there is something about that you don't need to read any great classic works of political thought to understand. It's instinctive. But as you say, it's very poorly represented. This very simple, and I would say very traditional way of thinking. I mean, you can look back to antiquity, you can look to the Bible, you can look to Thomas Aquinas, all the way down that you have primary responsibility for your people who are immediately in your circle, starting with your household and extending outward from there, and yet very poorly represented. I'll say one final thing about this. I think it is starting to reassert itself, though, because I think these statements by, well, let's say Marjorie Taylor Greene and maybe even others, to the effect that they sent $40 billion to Ukraine and we don't have baby formula here, there's something wrong about that. I think that's coming from that kind of discarded, forgotten tradition of conservatism.
Yeah, I think you see that as well in foreign policy. There are a lot of people on the right who, they sympathize with the plight of Ukrainians. They do believe, you know, in a certain sense, in American leadership in the world. But they fundamentally don't believe that, you know, we need to be sending $40 billion abroad when we have shortages in the local, you know, grocery store. As I've said, there's a source of conservatism underrepresented among elite conservatives, intellectual conservatives. But you're quite right to cite Bill Kaufman as an example of someone who does have, you know, a strong ability to express this form of conservatism. You also find it among the Southern agrarians. You find it among many so-called Northern agrarians. I think someone like G.K. Chesterton often gives expression to this as well. And Chesterton has other sources for his conservatism as well. And we'll talk about those in sequence here. But many conservatives, especially the conservatives of a more paleo-conservative or traditionalist orientation, they're drawing at least something of their worldview from this sense of local patriotism and country patriotism. One of the things I point out too is that, you know, there's this old dichotomy in English politics between the court party and the country party. The court party would be the members of parliament who are basically in the pocket of the king back in the 18th century. So they're currying favor with the establishment, basically, and they're looking to get knighthoods and so forth. The country party are those who are very critical of the court party and very critical of the king and very critical of centralized power, and instead see the traditional liberties of the land being invaded and encroached upon by centralized power. And there's a very strong connection, of course, between the American Revolution and this country party ideology in England. The American Revolution was all about preserving the independence of American localities against this attempt at imperial centralization by Parliament and by the king. So, you know, this local patriotism that is very much dismissed by elites, you know, both in the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, this local patriotism is, in fact, the very, very heart and foundation of America itself. So I think it always comes back. It has some capacity to regenerate itself. But as we may discuss a little bit later on, I do think it's facing some new challenges today that are more dangerous and destructive, and they're undermining it to a greater degree than we've ever seen before in our history.
All right, let's jump ahead to what you call the philosophy of balance. This is derived, I guess, from the Scottish Enlightenment. But talk about that a bit, because this was what I was wondering if we would see in your list of four.
Yeah, the philosophy of balance is a term I'm using simply because there's no really good word, one commonly accepted term for this philosophy. You've referred to the Scottish Enlightenment. So yes, Adam Smith and David Hume are both sources of inspiration for this point of view, for this stream within conservatism. But it's not just the Scottish Enlightenment. So someone like Edmund Burke also is a representative of this stream of thought. And more recently, people like Thomas Sowell. This is an area of conservatism that overlaps with a certain kind of classical liberalism up to a point. And I think it especially overlaps with the more sober kind of French classical liberalism. So someone like Alexis de Tocqueville also exhibits this philosophy of balance. The difference, I think, however, between the conservative version of the philosophy of balance and the tendency within classical liberalism is that classical liberalism tends to lead people to think that differences can always be worked out and reconciled, that fundamentally harmony and cooperation rather than conflict is persistent within human society, or should be or could be, if only we apply our reason more effectively to the design of institutions and to our way of operating and dealing with other people. And I think the conservative side tends to say that the conflict never really goes away. The conflict can be managed. You can have a balance of forces, but you can never really have a steady and stable harmony. Instead, there has to be a certain amount of dynamic back and forth. So James Madison, I think, in Federalist 10, he is an exemplar of this philosophy of balance. Free market economics can be an example of this philosophy of balance as well, that free market economics understands people act economically out of self-interested motives. They act competitively. They want, you want your firm to do well, not just because you want to make more money, but you also sometimes want your firm to do well out of a spirit of emulation, as David Hume and other 18th century thinkers called it. Emulation meaning not imitation, but rather rivalry, rather the idea that you want to compete in the same lane as someone else and outdo them. That spirit of competition and rivalry and emulousness is a key part of human nature, and it's a key part of much of what's great about human achievement, especially in the modern era. But of course, it also leads into problems because, sometimes people are so overcome by the spirit of emulation that they want to resort to cheating or that they succumb to resentment of other people. There's also an attitude towards religion that one finds among people who adhere to the philosophy of balance, which tends to creep a little bit towards utilitarianism, but it certainly highly emphasizes the need for religion as a social factor, a social power. And what religion does is it helps to bind people together, helps to create a sense of common feeling. It also acts as a balance for these sort of more selfish impulses that human beings will always experience. So religion is something that helps people get beyond their sense of pure self-interest. And religion is something that also helps to provide succor if they are unsuccessful in life. And Edmund Burke actually is quite eloquent on that point, that you need a source of spiritual consolation. And that is one thing that the church provides. And without the church, without that kind of consolation, you would instead have a lot of negative emotion, a lot of self-recrimination, and a lot of jealousy and resentment build up within society. And that would be expressed in politics in things like the French Revolution. So the philosophers of balance are, I think, very good human psychologists, and they have a very dark picture of human nature. And in some ways, back at the origins of this school of thought, one can even find, a certain influence from Niccolo Machiavelli, not in the sense of, wanting to manipulate people, but rather in the sense of understanding that human politics and human society, and in fact, individual human psychology, all involve dealing with a lot of, sort of unruly powers, a lot of selfishness, a lot of glory seeking and vainglory. And traditionally, you know, moralists have wanted to eliminate these things. They wanted to, you know, teach people how to be more virtuous. And, you know, people from drawing from the philosophy of balance, they certainly do value virtue, but they understand that virtue is always going to be imperfect, and that to a certain degree, you have to accept human beings and their flawed nature as it is, and try to work out ways in which there can be less conflict, or conflict could even be directed towards the benefit of society, rather than trying to eliminate conflict and create harmony. So again, Madison in the Federalist 10, you know, is showing the ways in which a large number of factions can actually, you know, not completely stabilize a large republic, but certainly provide some insulation against the problems that emerge in smaller republics, where a certain faction, a certain point of view, can more easily gain a monopoly on power and use that to try to tyrannize a minority.
You know, as I've been listening to this and the previous tradition you were describing, I don't see why a libertarian would have any disagreement with any of this. So if you had chosen, let's say, what we've been hearing about called national conservatism as one of the four, then I would have said, okay, well, I can see where there's going to be some problem. But I agree with everything you're saying so far. But let's go to the third one, even though you had it as the first. This one I'm not so convinced really stands alone as its own group, because there's not that much substance to it in terms, like, I know what the country patriot wants. I know exactly what he's got a list of demands. And likewise, I know that the group we just described, they understand the danger of totalizing ideologies. But talk to us about this public religion group.
Yeah, you know, these four sources that I describe, they're not meant to be quite at the level of a specific ideology like neoconservatism or paleoconservatism or southern agrarianism or what have you, or right libertarianism. What I'm trying to describe are the reasons why people consider themselves to be on the right or consider themselves to be conservative or anti-left in the first place.
Okay, so like the deep-rooted first principle that motivates them.
And in some ways, it's even anterior to principle. It's rather the emotional matrix that leads you to want to express one principle or another.
Okay.
So for some people, that is simply based on, you know, their loyalty to their home. And for other people, it is based upon a set of ideas. It really is intellectual, and it's based upon this philosophical view of human nature that I described with the philosophy of balance. And then for other people, and I think actually the largest number of people on the right, it is religion. And it's the idea that they are an adherence to a religious faith, a particular religious faith. They might be Protestant, they might be Catholic, they might be Jewish or anything else. And this faith is not compatible with, you know, hard left progressivism, especially if it's the orthodox version of the faith, right? You know, progressives are oftentimes infiltrating religions and moving them in a progressive direction, which ultimately leads to, you know, certain versions of Episcopalianism, which are indistinguishable from either Unitarianism or just progressive political correctness. But Orthodox religion, whether you're talking about traditional Catholics, maybe Latin Mass Catholics, certain traditional Calvinists and other Protestants, you know, especially really, you know, strongly faithful Orthodox Jews, these religious commitments are often the reason why people are conservative and why they're not leftist. And these faith traditions often come with requirements that the faith not be something that you simply practice, you know, on Sunday, that it's not simply something that applies within your own household, but rather that the truth of religion is something that should be proclaimed publicly and proclaimed broadly. Now, what that means differs with different traditions, and it differs even within a given tradition in terms of how people express it. So for a lot of Americans who are conservatives for religious reasons, it is absolutely sufficient if you simply elect men and women of faith to public office. And then those men and women of faith, they won't be just directly imposing their faith on other people. What they'll be doing is they will be voting and acting according to the values that have been formed in them by their religious tradition. And I think, you know, both Protestants and Catholics tend to view that as the most appropriate form of the connection between religion and the public space. But of course, you also have people who have a much stronger view of the need to combine the public sphere and religion. You know, among some of our, you know, very hardline Protestant friends, you have something like Christian Reconstructionism, which, you know, has often, you know, said that you should have biblical law in place in local communities. And I won't go into all the details of how they think that would emerge, but that is certainly the objective that Christian Reconstructionism has. On the Catholic side of things, there is a school of thought called integralism, which believes that, you know, we need to get back to confessional states, and the state needs to recognize the truth and the authority of Catholic teaching and the Catholic Church in order to have just laws and a well-ordered society. Now, these sorts of very strong integrations of religion and the state and the public sphere are rather impractical, I think it's fair to say. And they're not things which are likely to be brought about in their sort of full conception anytime. However,
well, not to mention, given that people who are in leadership roles, let's say, in these churches don't believe this. There's no Catholic bishop who's advocating that. So good luck trying to establish a church that doesn't even want to be established.
That's right. Yeah, I think that is a difficulty that advocates of that position are facing. Nevertheless, you know, these more strong forms of integrating religion and the public sphere, they do inspire a lot of very interesting thinkers. You know, you have someone like Adrian Vermeule at Harvard University and Harvard Law School. You have a number of sort of very talented young people on the right who are taking new views of the American founding, of federalism, its relationship to natural law and whatnot, drawing inspiration from these streams of thought. So again, I want to say that the religious source of conservatism can find a lot of different kinds of expression, some of which are indirect and involve simply, you know, wanting to express one's religious values through voting and through electing people of a certain kind of character to office. But then in other manifestations, the religious source of conservatism can lend itself to a much stronger institutional representation or direct representation in law or in the public square.
Hey folks, quick message from Ole Woods here. If you are looking to add Bitcoin to your retirement account and thinking about the long haul, then the best and easiest way to do that is with BitTrust IRA. BitTrust IRA helps you seamlessly and securely add cryptocurrency to your portfolio. It stores your private keys in nuclear bunkers with military-grade encryption. They have a 24/7 trading platform with no minimum investments and unlimited trades, plus a team to help guide you along the way if you have any questions. They also offer the lowest trading fees in the industry. I've often said that if Bitcoin is ever to gain more widespread acceptance, it's going to have to be more user-friendly, and BitTrust IRA could not be easier to use. So go to bittrustira.com/woods today to learn more. And for a limited time, BitTrust IRA is waiving the sign-up fee for Tom Woods Show listeners, a $50 value. That's bittrustira.com/woods, bittrustira.com/woods. All right, and then finally, anti-leftism. I think that's fairly easily understood, but you're careful to say this isn't just dumb people who don't understand anything, who just have an instinctual revulsion against this or that particular cause. There's more to it than that.
Yeah, as the failures of progressivism manifest themselves, whether, you know, in terms of rising crime in urban areas or, you know, just the madness that the left is trying to impose upon people in public schools, you get a backlash against it. And, you know, many progressives and people on the left would just look at the backlash and say, oh, this is just stupid. This is just reactionary. But in fact, a lot of very sharp conservative thought comes from ex-leftists. It comes from people who used to be on the left, but who were sort of mugged by reality or, you know, sort of just so revolted by the excesses of leftism that they wound up moving to the right. So some of the earlier neoconservatives, for example, followed this path. A great many anti-communists followed this path during the Cold War. They had been, you know, communists of various kinds themselves, some of them, you know, within the Communist Party and supporting Stalin, some of them Trotskyists. And they came to recognize the evil of the communist system in all of its forms. And then they moved to the right. And this is one reason, by the way, why some of these political pilgrims of the 20th century became, on the one hand, leading conservatives, but on the other hand, often seemed to be ill at ease with other parts of the conservative coalition. So if you are reacting against the left by leaving behind your, you know, former connections to communism or to, you know, other forms of radical ideology, you might become on the right by default because you're now opposing the left, but that doesn't mean you necessarily have any new and strengthened connection to your local, you know, sort of home community ethos. It doesn't mean that you necessarily have embraced religion, and it doesn't mean necessarily that you have, you know, begun to think of yourself as a Burkean or someone who is a subscriber to the philosophy of balance. It could be that you're just an opponent of the left, but still a very sophisticated and, you know, intellectually sort of well-versed opponent of the left. But also, then you see at the grassroots level that whenever people are horrified by the rising crime rates that we see in our cities, and in fact, in many small towns as well, that too leads people to want to elect tough on crime Republicans and politicians who are going to put more, you know, criminals in jail, that are going to, you know, increase prison terms, and who are going to not tolerate shoplifting and fare evasion and all of these sort of what have sometimes been called broken glass or issues or broken windows issues. James Q. Wilson, one of the sort of sociologists and neoconservatives of the late 20th century, he had this theory called the broken windows hypothesis, which says that when you have a neighborhood where there are a lot of broken windows, you start to have more crime accumulating because people just have a sense of disorder and have a sense that there are no standards that need to be upheld. And so if you start to fix those broken windows and, you know, create neighborhoods that are clearly more orderly, that has a certain psychological effect in discouraging crime and encouraging people to be more law-abiding. I do think, even though I've described much of this anti-leftism in terms that might match up with neoconservatism, there are also forms of anti-leftism which are very much at the heart of the Donald Trump movement. And so the rejection that one sees among Trump supporters of, you know, all of these left-wing pieties and all these left-wing policies, that too arises from anti-leftism and from a recognition that the left is simply monstrous. And what it's trying to impose on us is insane and deadly. And so people are looking for the strongest possible champion who will express an opposition to the left. And, you know, American politics right now is very much characterized by negative partisanship. People don't love the political parties. They don't vote for a political party that they like. They vote against the political party that they really fear and hate. And, you know, the progressive Democrats, they have generated a lot of opposition to themselves. And that opposition is looking not to elect the most Republican, right? They're looking to elect the most anti-leftist Republican. And I think you saw that in 2016, where you had all of these different flavors of Republican and conservative ideology on display. And voters didn't want that. They didn't want Ted Cruz, you know, Mr. Checklist Conservatism. They didn't want the latest edition of the Bush dynasty. What they wanted was Donald Trump, because Donald Trump was actually much more willing to confront the left and to say provocative things than any, you know, Republican who was more focused on his positive ideology would have been.
So I've been very interested since Trump got elected in where the public or what the public face of conservatism was going to begin to look like, because I felt like that's toothpaste that can't be pushed back into the tube. It cannot be the face of Mitt Romney forever at this point. Something has changed, and possibly for good. And it's interesting to observe the Romney sort of people, and I include Dan Crenshaw in that. I actually do, because he was attacking Marjorie Taylor Greene for saying, you know, maybe we shouldn't be doing this Ukraine thing. And, you know, again, calling her a Russian propagandist. And I mean, with no actual arguments, just exactly what the New York Times would say about her. And I frankly have been encouraged to see people making the kind of arguments I would make, which is, look at the crazy priorities of these people. They put absolutely everyone in the world ahead of you. What is it going to take for you to realize this? So now that we are in this position that you described at the beginning of your piece, where although the left has a tremendous foothold in institution after institution, there is a massive resistance to it. It's not organized. It's not as disciplined as the left itself is, but it's out there. So, you know, I hate to ask you and I are kind of both historians in a way. I hate to ask you about the future, but I am curious to know. I don't think Mitt Romney just comes back and they act like this ever happened. I know some Trump people who thought that would happen, that Trump would just be an aberration, the Romney people would be back in charge, and all these sort of little distinctions you're making in your article would go by the wayside because Romney would just hand over everything to our enemies. I'm not so convinced that that's the way it's going to go. And moreover, I think it's very interesting to see the kinds of ratings that a Tucker Carlson has. I mean, Tucker is the most anti-establishment guy on TV, and he's actually winning the main demographic. I think it's 25 to 54, the demographic that makes advertisers salivate. He's winning that among Democrats. Now, not all of those people are watching him because they want to keep an eye on what their enemies are saying. That's an amazing finding. So there is the prospect that conservatism could take an interesting turn. What do you see happening? What would be your ultimate, like, greatest, most favored possible outcome? And then what do you think is likely to happen?
Yeah, I think maybe I'll answer that in reverse. So one thing I should point out is that these four sources of conservatism, you know, they are theoretical silos as opposed to being kind of exclusive categories in real life. So real flesh and blood conservatives are going to be drawing, you know, usually from more than one of these sources. And people can change over time. They can, you know, sort of shift the foundations of their thought or the motives behind their thought. So I don't want to create the impression that, you know, each of these streams is completely distinct from the others and that there's no crossover. I think they're conceptually distinct, but in true human beings, they're going to be a mixture. Now, I do argue in my essay, and I think this is correct, that the left is responsible for creating the kind of conservative that they are actually most afraid of. What I mean by that is the first three sources of conservatism, local patriotism, country patriotism, religion, and the philosophy of balance, these are all things that have a very strong positive commitment to civilization. They're all things that clearly have some components that the most mild kind of progressive would find acceptable and relatively non-threatening. Progressives, you know, don't like traditional religion. They don't like, you know, local community, especially of the more, you know, sort of what I'm calling, you know, patriotic localism, that variety. They just dislike the realism, basically, of the philosophy of balance. Progressives are much more utopian than that. Nevertheless, you know, you'll find that there are progressives and other people on the left who they have respect for, you know, sort of Burkean conservatives. You know, they'll say nice things about William F. Buckley Jr. They talk about how they are not, you know, they don't think of themselves as being hostile to religion in every respect. And, you know, and they understand that, you know, people will have some degree of loyalty to their local communities. And yet, what is the program that the left and that progressives have actually adopted? The program they've adopted and that they're imposing both through their control of public institutions like the public schools and the federal government, especially the federal bureaucracy, and they're imposing it through the power they have in the private sector as well, in corporate America with, you know, HR departments and whatnot, in private universities and schools, in the private media, in, you know, the Washington Post and in the social networks. What the left is imposing is a framework and a set of beliefs that completely destroy those three sources of conservatism, right? So when you pursue a kind of economic globalism and when you pursue policies that are constantly federalizing and nationalizing elections and nationalizing, you know, who gets to use what bathroom and whatnot, when you have that sort of universalistic leftist agenda, you obviously weaken local communities. You make them subject to national federal bureaucracies. And as local communities also become less economically capable of setting their own destiny, as they become more and more dependent on what happens in Washington, D.C., or for that matter, in Beijing, that people start to then lose their connection. They're, you know, because the connections are not just emotional, they're not just loose and touchy-feely. The connections that bind local communities together are a combination of emotions and habits and economic ties. And economic ties often reinforce habits. They reinforce these personal connections. You go to the local store and you see the guy, the clerk face to face, and you have a little conversation. That kind of experience is starting to disappear in more and more of America, that people are more reliant on internet commerce and they're more reliant on sort of remote work and they're more reliant on economic decisions that are being made in DC and indeed in Beijing. So as the local community becomes kind of less economically coherent, and as it becomes, you know, sort of more and more assailed by national media and by national corporations that say, well, we need to, you know, sort of encourage all of you to understand transsexuality now and we need to make sure that you're, you know, sort of not too Southern in your character, not too, you know, sort of red state or connected to your old way of doing things. As you destroy that kind of local patriotism, what do you create? Instead of people being able to say, I'm a conservative because of my ancestors, they say, no, I'm a conservative now because I hate what's being done to me. I hate what the left is trying to impose upon me. So the left destroys a tradition that had, you know, various moderating and humane elements, and they encourage people instead simply to be traditionalist, to be alienated, and to be, in a sense, more reactionary and more anti-left simply because they're opposed to the left and not because they have a positive commitment to something else. You see the same thing with the left's approach to religion. The left is constantly trying to demonize people of orthodox religious beliefs. It's constantly, you know, portraying them as misogynists, as, you know, would-be totalitarians. It's saying that, you know, if you're a person of faith and you don't want to not just bake a cake for a gay wedding, but actually, you know, have to write on the cake, you know, whatever slogans people having the gay wedding have called for, you don't have a right of conscience anymore. The left will say, no, you have to not only make that cake, you have to put on that cake, whatever it is that your, you know, customer is requiring. So you weaken religious commitments and you create the sense that religion is powerless to defend itself against these onslaughts by the left, by corporate America, by the bureaucracy. And you generally, you know, sort of mock religion and you cause religion to lose its prestige in our society. And then what happens? Well, if people aren't going to have a positive religious reason for wanting to be conservative, instead, they're not going to have, you know, the sort of milder elements that come from religion. They're simply going to respond to what's being imposed upon them by the left, and they're going to be radicalized, and they're going to become what I say in one of my articles is a kind of mixture of Friedrich Nietzsche and Beavis and Butthead, right? It'll just be this, you know, sort of strong, visceral dislike of the left without any of the humanizing and, you know, sort of milder elements that come from religion. It's just going to be kind of Nietzsche. It's going to be a rejection of the idols of the left. And then, of course, you have the philosophy of balance. And where are people going to learn that today? Well, they're certainly not going to learn it, unfortunately, from a lot of libertarian educational institutions, which are instead doing the same thing the left is doing in terms of combining wokeism with a certain sort of very vague sense of self-fulfillment and human autonomy and whatnot. So left libertarians are certainly not teaching that. A lot of, you know, right-wing institutions, you know, for various reasons, are not doing a good job of teaching the philosophy of balance. And certainly the universities are not doing it. The universities, if they're talking about David Hume and Edmund Burke and Adam Smith and James Madison, they're talking about them all as dead white males who are, you know, cis-heterosexual, patriarchal, racist, homophobes or whatever. So the left is creating this impression of our history and our intellectual tradition, which is all just a history of villainy and oppression. So as a result, you're not going to continue creating people who are drawing their conservatism from this philosophy of balance. And what's going to fill the vacuum? Well, instead, you have all of this sort of warped history that's being imposed upon people by the left, and people are going to respond to that. They're going to say, you know what, I'm kind of sick of being told that I should be ashamed of my country and ashamed of the fact that Western civilization has brought about, you know, more human prosperity and more growth, not only in economics, but in terms of human population than any other system ever has. And that I'm kind of sick of being, you know, told that I need to be ashamed of my country's history and my civilization's history, but I shouldn't be thinking about Aztecs ripping the beating hearts out of, you know, the victims that they're sacrificing to their pagan gods. People are going to just be so pissed off by the left's politically correct demands of their beliefs that they're going to turn against the left and vote for a, you know, a very hardline anti-left version of the right. So the left, ironically, has created the conditions for someone like Donald Trump. And frankly, I think the left is very much underestimating the extent to which Donald Trump is actually a moderate. And if the left keeps doing this, and if it keeps more and more desperately clinging to power and trying to totalize that power over every, you know, sphere of human activity in America, you're going to see stronger and stronger reactions that will go even farther than Donald Trump has gone. And what that will look like, I don't know. You know, one of the things I fear is, you know, that someone like Tom Cotton might take issues like immigration and crime and combine those with, you know, certain kinds of sort of old-fashioned imperialism, and that he would be able to, you know, sort of cash in on anti-left sentiment in that way. There's a lot of danger here. And I think the left is being very foolish by destroying the forms of conservatism that are a little more merciful and encouraging the creation instead of the most hardline, you know, sort of anti-left ideology. Now, having said that, I am kind of optimistic. I think it is appropriate that the anti-left should be growing stronger and stronger right now under current conditions. But I do think there will come a time when we need to reassert these other three streams of these other three sources of conservatism. And so the question is, can you make that segue? Can you take an American right that has been conditioned to be primarily anti-left, and can you start to reintroduce into it some of the character traits as well as beliefs that are characteristic of country patriotism, of religious orthodoxy, and the philosophy of balance? I'm hopeful that we can do that, and I think there will be an opportunity. But the more that the left continues to, you know, aspire towards totalistic power, the more difficult it will be in the future to restore these other sources of conservatism, and the more likely it will be that you'll just have an anti-leftism, which will be very politically powerful. It'll be very capable of, you know, sort of setting the masses in motion. But I don't know that it'll necessarily have much power to build and to fulfill human nature. And it's actually, in the long run, I think, a tendency that would lead to, you know, sort of more and more hostility within our country. Because, of course, you know, the left will be screaming about, you know, not just racists and whatnot, but fascists and Nazis. And the left is creating, I'm saying, a self-fulfilling prophecy of a kind of very hard right that is, you know, bereft of the more civilizing tendencies that have historically formed conservatism.
I honestly thought the soil was not right in the U.S. for the creation of a right wing like that, because it's been so tame and relatively timid and following the rules, and they watch the other side flout every rule around and live by a double standard, and yet they still continue to put their heads down and write their policy papers. And so I just thought maybe they just didn't have it in them. But as you say, what could emerge from this could be something that nobody particularly wants. All I want to see are people who are, you know, in this despised class just stand up for themselves. That's really all I want. There's nothing necessarily wicked about that, or that doesn't have to take a disturbing form. I just want them to stand up for themselves. And they can do that with humor. They can do it with toughness. They can, however they want to do it, but just stand up for themselves. That's what I want. And it looks like that's already coming. I mean, if you look on, this is not a great indicator, but it's not nothing. If you look on social media and you look at some establishment person reporting on, for example, that Joe Biden now is sending troops into Somalia, it's surprising how many people are saying, oh, here he goes again, doing anything other than the actual things he should do, or I'm sick and tired of trying to having to worry about what's going on in Somalia. At some point, this can't be our problem anymore. It's surprising how much of that is there. There is a lot of it.
Yeah, that's right. And I don't want to create the impression that the anti-left stream of right-wing sentiment is always or even primarily a bad thing. On the contrary, it's usually a very healthy thing, but it's a healthy thing up to a certain limit. And one of its limitations is that I do think it has a rather modest capacity to create, you know, a kind of fulfilling human community on any scale. So, you know, if you're anti-left, if you, you know, reject what the left is doing, that's great. But then what do you get in its place? So it's kind of the flip side of the problem that the left itself has generated. The left is, you know, failing ideologically. And so some form of the right is going to have more and more success over time. But you can see conversely, if you have a right which is starting to rise, but it really doesn't have, you know, any deeper sense of human community and human relationships and human nature than simply being opposed to whatever it is that the left stands for, that you're going to wind up with unsatisfactory public arrangements with that in the long run. In the short run, you know, it's not an issue, but in the long run, you really do need something positive and not simply negative in order to have a healthy polity. And I think there's this great sort of not only intellectual riches, but a patrimony of civilization to be found in those other three sources of the right. And so I think it would be a great shame if they were to continue to diminish and to lose their salience as a result of the left creating such a heavily polarized condition that you basically just have a left and an anti-left as opposed to a healthy country with these other healthy sources of conservatism. And, you know, I really do worry that we've created such a system of profound alienation in our country, you know, such a weakness and a despair throughout the land. And you see this, you know, in terms of the fentanyl addictions and, you know, other opioid abuse. You see it in, you know, I mean, you know, I deal with a lot of conservatives, both at the elite level and, you know, at the level of students and elsewhere. I see a lot of conservatives who unfortunately do show the, who fit the description that Peter Viereck gave of many conservatives way back in the late 1940s and 1950s, which is there is a kind of rootless longing for roots and a certain sense in which you have people who don't have a tradition trying to find a tradition. The dangerous thing about that is that you can have people wind up, you know, sort of grabbing onto traditions that are in fact destructive. And you wind up with a right which, for all its professions of, you know, standing up for ideas or standing up for traditional religion or for local community, in fact, is not really attached to any of those things, but is simply using them as weapons against the left. And I do see some of that starting to happen. I don't think, again, that it's reached a critical tipping point, that it's a major problem right now. But we do need to have sources of civilizational renewal that go beyond simply opposing the progressive agenda. And those sources of civilizational renewal have to be found in these other streams of conservatism.
And I might add, as we wrap up, that it has to be acknowledged that in blue cities, this is where you find, for all the problems and disasters, this is where you find museums, theater, Shakespeare theater, symphony orchestras playing European symphonies. You find that there. Now, it's not to say you don't find that in red states. Of course you do. The Alabama Shakespeare Festival is an amazing institution, for example. But you really do find it at its highest levels of achievement in these places. And so it's not enough to just curse the darkness, as they used to put it. It's better to, in addition to that, to light a candle. And it'd be nice to see more of our side lighting that candle. I mean, I know you can only do so much and you're up against an enemy that wants to destroy everything you hold dear. But that's a time partly to play defense, but also partly to build. We have to build something. We're not just here to say no to these people. We should be here to build something that's great. ModernAgeJournal.com is the website to get Modern Age delivered to you. Do you have any final words? I kept you way longer than I said I would. You can't believe a word I say.
Oh, I'll just go back to the beginning here and say that there's a parallel between our circumstances right now and those of the late Soviet Union and the collapse of the communist bloc at the end of the 1980s and beginning of 1990s. In the same way that communism had failed, but then the question became what was going to follow it, that's what we're facing now. So I've often thought that America might wind up confronting a kind of Boris Yeltsin moment where, you know, we have started to break away from leftism, and yet we don't really have any kind of strong leadership or clear direction for the country. Instead, we just have a kind of entropy. And, you know, American leftism, while it is on the one hand not in practice, doesn't have the totalitarian power that the Soviet Union had. And I am, you know, sort of, I realize the limits of that parallel and that analogy. It is a very persistent ideology, and I think it's going to, you know, continue to haunt us for some time. But I do worry that we have destroyed the traditional sources of civilization to such an extent that renewal becomes very difficult. And simply seeing the left defeated, even as satisfying as that is only step one. And the harder work will come later in terms of rebuilding and, you know, sort of reestablishing a healthy environment for the human soul. That is a tremendous challenge. And I do fear that, you know, a lot of people are thinking that that's a lot easier than it actually is. And that if they were to come in and basically try to do all the things that the left is doing, but to do them under the imprimatur of religion or the imprimatur of American patriotism or something, that they will fall short and they'll simply create new opportunities for the left to make a comeback. Instead, we really have to be honest about the extent to which Americans have been sort of psychologically and morally damaged by generations of leftist power. And that in order to help to, you know, sort of cure and lead people to back to civilization, it's going to be a very difficult task, and it's going to require an enormous amount of moral education and intellectual education. I do think, by the way, that one of the sort of troubling things here is that while, you know, sort of boomer conservatives for a long time have, you know, often been the complacent type that you've described, the type who would just go along with Mitt Romney and with anything that the left does, Now, perhaps you're starting to find some boomer conservatives who are just fed up, mad as hell, not going to take it anymore. But the younger conservatives, they're both, on the one hand, a source of great hope. So I see a lot of millennials and Generation Z conservatives who are intellectually very well-formed, who are spiritually very well-formed. But I do worry that most of their generation, the ones who are not sort of well-formed conservatives, they're very psychologically damaged and they're very much in the grip of despair and hopelessness. I think Jordan Peterson alludes to this, you know, often quite effectively in his remarks. And this is a generation that in some ways has never known civilization. It's only known the left-wing attack upon civilization and left-wing anti-civilization. And I do fear that this generation is going to have a very hard time understanding truth and beauty when these things have been never part of their experience in the classroom and in the virtual reality that social media has constructed.
Wow. Well, I guess this conversation had to run this long because what we're trying to get to here is the work of, I don't want to say the work of centuries, but it is the work that people who are in the process of rebuilding something, trying to prevent the destruction of something completely and trying to rebuild it, the kind of conversation they need to have. So thank you, Daniel. I promise next time when I say, come on my show and we'll talk for X minutes, you'll be able to rely on me a little bit better. The website, once again, modernagejournal.com. Thanks again, Dan.
Thanks, Tom.
All right, folks. I mentioned that between now and the end of June, there may be the occasional odd week where you have only 4 episodes of The Tom Woods Show. Well, this is one of those weeks, but I gave you an hour-long episode today. That's like 2 episodes. So maybe, you know, in your brain, you could think of it as a 5-episode week. But regardless, no need to adjust your set. It's just that I'm doing 4 episodes a week here and there between now and the end of June. We'll just make them as good and juicy as we can. So that is our episode for today. If you want to be part of the cream of the crop, the inner circle, the elite of the Tom Woods Show, then head over to supportinglisteners.com. Wait till you see all the goodies you get as a supporter of the Tom Woods Show and to be able to say you are part of the elite. So check that out. I'll see you all tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.